foreign affairs. It's a symbolic weakness as well as a sign of partisan activity. More subtly, in terms of explaining this unpreparedness, the political culture of Stalinism also had its effects on Soviet ability to be prepared, in particular the military. Only a few hours before the attack, officers on the frontier were given direct orders not to give way to provocative actions. Now, Stalin was convinced that Hitler would not violate the Nazi-Soviet pact and attack unless there was a just excuse, unless there was a provocation. And his notion is if the troops at the in the front rose to high military preparedness, Hitler could say, you're about to attack, and that's why I attacked you. So he ordered them not to give way to provocative actions. And Russian Soviet military officers used to obeying orders, autonomy and judgment, were certainly not encouraged, especially in the wake of the Great Terror. These officers, therefore, did nothing. And they had to wait 2 hours after the invasion began until they received orders to fight back, and only then did they do so, after already great loss. As you can probably already see by these descriptions, a key factor in Soviet lack of preparedness was Stalin himself, especially Stalin's critical and blind conviction that the pact with Germany was his own brilliant maneuver that would effectively protect the USSR by first creating a buffer zone through these annexed territories, though they made no useful use of this buffer zone. But most importantly, Stalin believed that he had created a document that effectively tied Hitler's hands. He really seemed honestly to believe that Hitler would not attack unless attacked. He was also certain that the Germans, once they fought this war that began immediately after the pact and the Germans invaded Poland, that this war in the West would so weaken Nazi Germany that it would either be completely defeated and therefore unable to attack Russia, even if it wanted to, or would be so weakened in the process of this war that should it decide eventually to attack the Soviet Union, it would be an easy force to defeat. It would be a protracted war in the West, he believed. It would be exhausting to all sides, which would also be useful in weakening the British and the French in case they eventually wanted to attack the USSR. And, of course, it all implied that an understanding of the West as being much stronger than it turned out to be against Nazi invasion. Of course, no one dared challenge Stalin's misconceptions, though there were plenty of high Soviets who understood he might be at error. In fact, Stalin had actually been warned about a planned German invasion on several occasions by British government, the British government, by the American government, and even by some of his own intelligence agents who said there were plans underway in Germany for an invasion. He chose to ignore these warnings. In fact, it seems he saw them as nothing but provocations to make him go to war against Nazi Germany, and he was certain it was unnecessary. To be fair, as you probably know, Hitler also made miscalculations in understanding the Soviet Union when he decided to invade Russia. First of all, he expected a rather short war, something like the invasion of France. He figured Russia would be no more difficult. After all, look how backward Russia was. Specifically, he was convinced that the Russian campaign would be won before the fall rains began, and especially before the notorious Russian winter. In fact, everyone recalled on both sides the history of Napoleon's famous and failed invasion of Russia in 1812. In fact, it said that a poster had been prepared to warn German troops against the idea of an invasion that had a picture of Napoleon, and underneath it the saying, "I tried it, I don't advise it." Instead, the war, of course, became long and protracted, an extended front, overextended supply lines, and worsening weather, which means in Russia mud and rain and ice, on top of which comes snow and bitter cold. Now, as the war dragged on, Russia was able to recover from the defeats of 1941, though not immediately. In the summer of 1942, a year into the war, the Germans launched a second invasion, a second offensive, rather, and a huge one it was. It involved about 100 divisions of German troops and perhaps as many as 1 million soldiers. They focused their attack this time on the south, partly in order to seize certain important industrial cities, but especially in order to get control of the enormously rich oil fields in the Caucasus. Once again, the Soviet army suffered serious losses, and the German army continued to advance. But once again, the Germans found that their success was not complete. They found themselves again forced to fight in the harsh Russian winter with overextended supply lines. The crucial battle in this campaign came at the city of Stalingrad, renamed, of course, from its earlier name of Tsaritsyn in order to honor Stalin, which came in the fall and winter of 1942. The Germans sent about 500,000 troops initially against Stalingrad. The Red Army, the Soviet Army, was completely determined and ordered to make a firm stand there. After all, this was the city whose name honored the leader of the Soviet Union. Hitler was also, in his own way, mesmerized by the symbolism of the city's name and was no less determined and gave no less vigorous orders that the city should be taken. The battle, which began in September of 1942, was long and bloody, lasting well into the winter. The Germans actually did quite well, though after exhausting struggle. They took the city, but against enormous resistance. There was fierce street fighting, both by regular troops that moved into the city to defend it, as well as by non-members of the military, by partisans. In fact, the city had to be taken virtually block by block, even house by house, sometimes room by room, in apartment buildings. And these battles often took place amidst devastating ruins of destroyed buildings. Meanwhile, while this battle, exhausting battle for both sides, dragged on, the Red Army was able to launch a counteroffensive. By November, it managed to surround the city, cut off the German army's already overstretched supply lines, and fully surrounded at this point 120,000 German and Romanian troops, which they brought in to support the effort, surrendered in January of 1943. This was the turning point in the war. And it's worth saying a turning point not only for Russia, but many have argued for the entire Allied cause against Nazi Germany. And from this point on, from Stalingrad on, the German army was in retreat, and the Red Army was rapidly moving westward. By the time the Second Front, long promised, and repeatedly delayed, by the time the Second Front actually opened with the Allied landing in Normandy in June of 1944, the Red Army had in fact almost already regained all of its lost territory and was moving west toward the heart of Germany. In another year, by 1945, Germany was defeated and Soviet troops were in Berlin. In many ways, this is a dramatic and remarkable story, but the story itself of the war begs a certain key questions. In particular, how was it the Soviet Union survived this onslaught? And how indeed did they even contribute, one might argue, as many historians have, to winning the war against Nazi Germany? And most importantly, what does it tell us about Soviet politics and Soviet society and Soviet culture and the Soviet people? What does this wartime experience tell us? Concerning survival, one factor is often pointed to, the rapidly improving quality of military command. And Stalin, in fact, deserves some credit for this. He proved quite ready, after these initial disasters, to fire incompetent commanders, of which there were many, who were clearly partly to blame for these early failings. And he fired them even if they were, as in many cases they were, personal friends of his, such as Klementy Voroshilov. And Semyon Budyonny, both Civil War buddies of his, he put in very high positions of command, neither very talented commanders. And in their place, he appointed highly competent military leaders such as Georgi Zhukov. Just as important, after these initial defeats, Stalin let the military experts make the major military decisions. Up till that time, he had interfered in every even tiny way with the policies of the army. Now he let the army command really run the war effort. No less important than the quality of command were the improvement of economic resources which the army would have at its disposal. By 1943, most accounts agree, the Red Army was supplied with sufficient quantities of weapons, ammunition, tanks, and airplanes. And in fact, the quality of this equipment continued to grow, and in some cases was actually superior to that of the weapons being used by the Germans, very often because of good quality plans that they had developed during the 1920s in cooperation with Germany, none of which had been yet implemented, but now were. Now, part of the reason for this improved quality of military equipment was also lend-lease, aid from Britain and the United States, though most of the credit has to go to Russia's own resources. Industrialization itself in the 1930s, however, at great cost, had actually laid a groundwork for making military equipment by focusing on a big industry and the metal industries and machine tools. Most importantly, the highly centralized nature of the Soviet economy actually enabled it to much more quickly mobilize resources and adapt production immediately to war needs than an economy that didn't have such central direction. And one can see this most visibly in the mass evacuation, something that only a highly centralized government could do, of thousands of factories and millions of workers to the east, away from the Russian heartlands, beyond the Ural Mountains, where they would be out of German hands. Indeed, this evacuation did much to keep Russia's industry safe from occupation and allowing it to mobilize its economy. Now, this mobilization of economic resources and of military resources was obviously an important part of Russia's success and survival. But no less critical was the mobilization of human resources. And this brings us to another key question. What did this war mean for Soviet people? Also, how was it presented to them, and how did they understand it? Now, official propaganda and the mobilization of human resources was essential. Mobilization of people for the war effort was a critical part of the purpose the state had in mind in launching a massive propaganda campaign. And this propaganda was filled with stories of heroism and courage and sacrifice. And it's worth saying this isn't just propaganda. Much of it was quite real, and they could tell real stories. One can see this heroism and courage and sacrifice in the high morale of the Red Army, the willingness, clear and often noticed by Allied forces who were there often as advisors, the willingness of soldiers to fight, their motivation, something rarely seen before in Russian history. One can also see it in the efforts of partisans, thousands of partisans, men, women, children, old people, who fought behind German lines without any central direction whatsoever. One sees it also in the impressive solidarity of non-combatants in horrible situations such as the siege of Leningrad, when the Germans blockaded and bombed and starved the city for almost the entire war. In fact, it's worth saying that never before in modern times, and certainly not in Soviet times, was the country so united. But this raised still more questions. What were the terms of this unity? To what purpose? What assumptions did people have as they came together so effectively? And what expectations? One way to answer this is to look at how the war was portrayed publicly in speeches and literature and films and newspapers, the themes that dominated public discourse, public propaganda that proved to be so popular. First of all, what the war was not portrayed as hardly ever was as about class war. This wasn't a class war, according to official propaganda. It wasn't about spreading world revolution. It wasn't even about socialism. Hardly anybody was ever asked to die for communism in the war. Most of all, the war was said to be about, officially, and indeed in people's minds as well, about nation and home and family. And to some extent for Stalin personally as great leader, but he was always portrayed here as the father of the nation, not as the general secretary of the Communist Party. Above all, the war was portrayed and evidently understood as a patriotic war of national resistance. It was a fight for survival of the nation as a whole, especially Russia, but indeed it was often talked about as if the Soviet Union were a nation. It was said that this was a fight to save the motherland, a term used very, very often, or the fatherland, a term also used. In fact, in this spirit, even the national anthem of the country was changed. In 1943, instead of the Communist Internationale being the anthem, a new patriotic song was chosen, which began with the words, "Glory to you, our free fatherland." Almost as important, and obviously connected, was the idea that the war was about the defense of home and family. Dozens of posters that appeared during the war showed women and children being horribly threatened by Nazis, cowering women and children with ugly-looking Nazis with large bayonets threatening them. And these posters and speeches called for defense and vengeance against them. In fact, in many ways, the war was understood in just these very personal terms. One sees the same sort of themes in journalism during the war, in literature, in film. We see stories of raped and murdered Russian women and calls for vengeance by the army or by any partisan willing to challenge the brutality of the Germans. We see stories of great personal heroism and sacrifice by men, but also by women and children, even martyrdom, as it was sometimes described, all about saving, serving one's nation and one's own dear loved ones. In contrast to these heroic and warm representations of Russians and their cause, the enemy was portrayed as nothing less than the personification of evil. The enemy was almost never, indeed, really never portrayed as a class enemy. This wasn't Marxist ideology that described what the enemy was. The enemy was a national enemy. It was against the motherland. And above all, the enemy was seen as a moral enemy, as evil fighting against good. Very often in posters, one sees images of Germans represented as vermin, as snakes, as rodents, even as enormous giant green slugs. And it was always said in these images that they should be killed and exterminated like the vermin they were. Now, these efforts to unite the nation weren't just symbolic, weren't just about words. The Soviet government and the Soviet party also took practical measures to strengthen popular support of the war effort. Expanding on efforts in the 1930s, for example, the church was in many ways rehabilitated, partly in return for supporting the war effort. Churches were reopened. Seminaries were reopened. The official atheist organization, the League of the Militant Godless, it was called, was closed. And in 1943, Stalin even agreed to the election of a new patriarch for the church, a post that had been restored in 1917. Remember, it had been gotten rid of by Peter the Great, but it essentially was soon suppressed and became inactive. Stalin restored it. Now, this rehabilitation of the church was directed especially at peasantry, the majority of the population, who in many ways were still quite religious. There were other efforts, but also to win more peasant support, the majority of the population, after all. In particular, peasants were given greater freedom to sell produce that was grown on their private plots. And indeed, as peasants enlarged their private plots without any official approval, the state looked the other way. Let them have more private agriculture. Let them sell things on an unofficial free market. As a result, by 1944, half of all marketed produce in the Soviet Union came from private plots, a de facto decollectivization almost. Now, these measures, both in words and in emotions, but also practical measures, all played a part in mobilizing the nation against the German invasion. One last factor, though, has to be taken into account. And that's the behavior of the Nazis themselves during the war, which made all of this propaganda so plausible. When the German army invaded, in fact, many Soviet citizens, especially in the western frontiers, the western borderlands of the Soviet Union, actually welcomed the Germans as liberators. They were soon painfully disappointed. Instead of liberating peasants from collective farms, which is exactly what many, especially Ukrainian and Belarusian peasants, hoped, there were no collective farms in Germany after all, instead the Nazis found the collective farms to be quite useful and used them as convenient structures for getting grain out of the Soviet Union. They also deported nearly 3 million civilians to slave labor camps in Germany. They deported Russians and Belarusians and especially Ukrainians who often most welcomed them. Millions of Jews, gypsies, communists were executed on the spot or sent to German death camps. And partisans, of which there were many, when captured or even suspected of being partisans, were tortured to find out who else was a partisan. And when whole villages were believed to support these partisans, sometimes the population of an entire village was simply murdered and the village burnt to the ground. Now, these policies weren't just a mistake. They were part of expressed Nazi thinking about Russia and about Russians. The Nazis officially viewed Russians and other Slavs not as people to be liberated, as so many of them perhaps thought was going to happen, but as Untermenschen, as subhumans to be exploited in the interests of greater Germany. For example, Heinrich Himmler, who was head of the SS and in charge of the occupation of the Soviet Union, made this explicit in a speech in 1941. He said, "If 10,000 Russian females die of exhaustion digging an anti-tank ditch, this interests me only insofar as if the ditch is dug." The stated German war aim, in fact, in the East, was to create an agricultural colony that would serve the interests of the German fatherland. It was not to free Russians from tyranny. And not surprisingly, this sort of Nazi behavior contributed to the enthusiasm with which Russians fought during the war. Ultimately, I think it's this popular determination to resist the Nazis that was the decisive factor in Soviet victory. And the government and the party wisely associated it with this and encouraged this determination to fight the Nazis as a challenge to themselves as individuals, to their families, and to their nation. The significance of this went beyond the war. In the long run, as I've suggested, this battle, the emotions behind it, the unity of the country, did more to bolster the legitimacy and the popularity of the Soviet regime than anything before. It was now truly a national government. In the shorter term, though, the mobilization of this popular support to free Russia from Nazi threat carried great political risks of its own. The Soviet people expected that after the war, they would be rewarded for their support in this battle. And indeed, they thought they would be rewarded with a better life, in particular with continued relaxation of the pressures that had existed in the past. Less mobilization of society, less talk about building communism, less repression, less violence. Instead, once the victory came and the war ended, they got a powerful return to the harsh order of the Stalinist past. Necessary, the government felt, to rebuild Russia from the devastations of the war.
Lecture 34, The Soviet Union After Stalin.
This lecture explores the Soviet experience in the years after the Second World War, years that were an important part of the lives of many Russians today, but also that in many ways produced the conditions that ultimately led to the collapse of the communist system in 1991. As I mentioned last time, the mood of most Soviet people at the end of the war was filled with hope and possibility. They were enormously relieved over their victory, indeed proud of their victory in this long and costly war. But they were also hopeful in many ways. They expected they would be rewarded for their support, for their victory, with a more relaxed life, with a more normal life by European standards. And instead, in the name of rebuilding the devastated country, and it was enormously devastated in the course of the war, instead they got a return to the disciplines, the repressions of the past on an intensified scale. For example, for most collective farmers, the large majority of the population, collectivization was re-strengthened. The lands that peasants had taken for their own private use, so critical to the marketing of grain during the war, were reappropriated and given back to the collective farms. And peasants were put under increasing pressures within these collective farms to deliver to the state more grain than ever before. In industry, investment was intensely directed at heavy industry, even compared to the degree of consumer support for consumer industry during the 1930s. Most production of consumer goods suffered enormously in the post-war period. Also, partly due to the shortages, prices of necessities even, food, clothing, were allowed by the government, which controlled prices, to rise dramatically. In the cities, there were terrible shortages of housing, which was not a priority in the post-war period. Better to rebuild industry than to rebuild housing. And the problem was an old problem, that people were crowded into these communal apartments, comunalki as they were called, but also due to the devastation during the war. Repair of buildings was very slow. Cultural life, intellectual life, was also severely restricted in these immediate post-war years. Writers or intellectuals who refused to conform, and many of which involved simply repeating the sorts of ideas of nation and national unity that were heard during the war, writers such writers and intellectuals were now viciously condemned in public for not adhering to the official party line of ideas and literature and art. To give one example, the poet Anna Akhmatova, who we've heard about before, a well-known poet from before the revolution and remained an important Soviet poet, was one of many leading writers in Soviet life condemned publicly by, in particular, a man named Andrei Zhdanov, who was one of Stalin's closest advisors and in charge of culture. And his critique was rather typical. It was harsh and it was crude. For her writing mostly about subjects like love and personal life, rather than about socialist construction, he declared she was nothing but a whore for her subject matter. This sort of suggests the tenor of the times in the post-war years. And finally, in its relations with the West, the old allies during the war, relations became more tense than they had been in years, certainly something reminding much more of the earlier Stalin years. During the war, of course, the alliance with England and the United States seemed to many Russians to promise an end to their long isolation, to their hostility to the West in the post-revolutionary years. And instead, a new, what was called Cold War, developed. Though, to be sure, it wasn't simply because of Stalin's attitudes or the Soviet side. Hostility to communism in the West was also an important reason for the development of this Cold War. And like the war itself, the Cold War wasn't simply a fact in international relations. As in other countries in particular, as in the U.S., the Cold War shaped, one might say deformed, everyday culture and politics in many ways. Above all, one saw this in a massive upsurge in officially promoted nationalism, Russian and to some extent Soviet nationalism, even outright xenophobia. Everything foreign was condemned in these years. People who showed respect for Western ideas were condemned as what were called rootless cosmopolitans, which was defined officially as servility before the degenerate bourgeois culture of the West. Rootless cosmopolitanism was also a euphemism for Jews, seen as lacking nation, who were particularly targeted in these years in a whole series of purges of Jews from various institutions. On the other hand, everything Russian was said to be the greatest in the world. The Russian language was said to be superior as a language and eventually would become the international language of the future. Russian literature was said to be superior to every language, every literature in the world. And somewhat less plausibly, indeed a great deal less plausibly, even many Western inventions were said to have been invented by Russians. For example, the cotton gin was said to be a Russian invention. To cap off all these regressive trends, it appeared that the last component of full-blown Stalinism was on its way, namely a new purge, a new terror, perhaps. In January of 1953, it was announced that a number of doctors working in the Kremlin, it turns out were mostly Jews, had been arrested for, as the it was alleged, conspiring to murder all the leaders of the country, starting, of course, with Stalin. Many people saw this declaration of this massive arrest to be the first step in a new terror against suspected enemies wherever they were to be found, a return of the terror of the late 30s. It was prevented, many believe, only by Stalin's death in March of 1953. After he died, on the 5th of March, his successors, the leaders of the party and the state, recognized they couldn't rule in the same way Stalin had. People were losing patience with it, and they lacked his charisma to even be able to carry it off. In particular, they realized they had to now pay more attention to the desires of the population for a normal life. There needed to be less repression. There needed to be less obsessive focus on ideology and propaganda. And there needed to be more realization of the promises being made for a better life, a better material life. Now, the story of how they did this, the story of the succession of regimes that followed Stalin, is a fascinating one. It starts with the reforms of Nikita Khrushchev, who headed the party in 1953 to 64. This involved an extensive program of what was called de-Stalinization, openly criticizing Stalin's repression and promising much less. Major efforts were also launched appropriately to stimulate and focus on the consumer economy. Indeed, public speeches and even posters that one would see and hear during Khrushchev's time were far more likely to talk about increasing hog production or bread production or building houses than building socialism. Khrushchev was forced from power in 1964, partly because of many of his policies actually didn't work, but also he became an increasing embarrassment of the Soviet Union before the world due to his failed international policies, most notably the Cuban Missile Crisis, but also the famous story of him pounding his shoe on the podium at the United Nations. He was followed by Leonid Brezhnev, who ruled for many years, 1964 to 1982, a period that became known officially as developed socialism. In practice, this developed socialism was, as we'll see when I describe it in more detail in a moment, very much like a socialist or any other sort of welfare state, but a welfare state in which the Communist Party jealously protected its absolute monopoly on political power. Personally, he was quite successful. Unlike Khrushchev, who was forced out of office for a variety of reasons, variety of failures in policy, and alienating many people in Russia due to his policies, Brezhnev died in office. Indeed, all the rulers that would follow would die in office until Gorbachev. Next came Yuri Andropov, who ruled from 1982 to 1984, who attempted to revitalize the most important thing, a stagnating economy. This was, of course, a vital economy essential to satisfying people's basic material desires, which increasingly the Soviet state and party recognized was essential to the success of the system. And yet, every year, growth rates continued to slow. Despite Andropov's efforts, he was an old man, an ailing man. He died within a couple of years. He was replaced in 1984 by even an older and sicker man named Konstantin Chernenko, who was determined to prevent any experiments at reform, such as Andropov began to think about during his brief reign. In fact, Chernenko really focused mostly on remaining functional himself. He was ailing, he could barely stand up when he was giving speeches, and in fact he died within only a few months after coming to power. Finally, as the sense of crisis in the country grew, especially around economics, a young man, the youngest man to be chosen as Soviet leader since Stalin, when Stalin was chosen in his relative youth, Mikhail Gorbachev was chosen to be party leader. He stayed in power from 1985 to 1991. He was only 54, seen as young by Soviet standards, Soviet leadership standards, when he came to power. He also became head of state in addition to being head of party in 1988. Now, rather than detail in greater specificity all the various policies of all these various rulers, though they will emerge as I tell the story of these years, I want to step back and take a somewhat larger view of post-Stalinist Soviet life. In particular, my focus is going to be on the long Brezhnev years. These were particularly important and revealing, partly for understanding post-Stalinist ideas about a power and order, but also for understanding how and why the system was heading toward radical reform or at least collapse, and indeed ultimately both reform and collapse. I'm going to begin with the nature of rule, of politics during these years, the exercise and maintenance of power after Stalin. And the key starting point for understanding power in the wake of Stalin was the relationship of the state to its own ruling elites, to what some have called the Russian ruling, the Soviet ruling class. It's rather significant that the Brezhnev regime took as its motto for politics in 1965 the phrase, trust in cadres. In other words, trust, have respect for personnel, for party and government officials, for the bureaucracy. In practice, this meant, first and foremost, that officials were assured of much greater job security than ever before. There was not to be any more of Stalin's purges, which so decimated the leadership. Nor would there be, as happened under Khrushchev, talks about the problems of bureaucracy, attacks on bureaucracy, reorganizations to make people less bureaucratic, limiting the amount of tenure one can hold in office, something else Khrushchev tried, or even encouraging public criticism of bureaucrats, something also under Khrushchev. Instead, people were assured of peace and longevity in their positions of power. And the most clear evidence of this new security was the dramatic aging of the leadership in the Soviet Union. By the late 1970s, most of the Soviet Union senior leaders were indeed really senior in almost every institution. They were mainly men, not very many women, in their 60s and 70s. Secondly, this phrase, trust in cadres, meant catering to their interests. This meant institutional interests, that whatever their department was should be assured of a good budget so one could function effectively. But it also meant, indeed above all, meant personal benefits, personal interests, personal privileges. In fact, the Brezhnev era has often been called the golden age of the Soviet elite. Especially this is true for a group of people known in Russian as the nomenklatura. This meant appointed government and party elites, appointed managerial elites. In other words, the appointed bureaucracy. But it also applied to people in the various professions, as well as, of course, at the top ranks of the party who made decisions. The extent of privileges for these people, for the bureaucracy, for the party elite, and for people high in the various professions was striking. Though, of course, it depended on how high you went as to how many privileges you have. For example, few ordinary Russians in these years could buy a car. Not only a question of cost, though they were very expensive, but Russians tried to save for this, but also availability. There were often years of waiting for an ordinary citizen to buy a car, even if they had managed to save the money for it. Elite status gave one ready access to the car market. And the higher the status, the better the car you were authorized to buy, often at good prices. Brezhnev, symbolically as head of the party, had a huge collection of luxury foreign cars. He had his own Rolls Royce, a Maserati, a Lincoln Continental, a Cadillac, and many more. There were also for this elite special stores that only members of the elite could shop at. And the higher the rank, the better the store. Here you would find better goods than you would find in an ordinary Soviet store. Most importantly, scarce goods that couldn't be found, even if they were Russian-made, were in too scarce supply, they went to the elite. One also found in these stores better service. The consequence of this was that many Soviet elites were spared the typical Soviet shopping experience. Chronic shortages, long lines, rude service. The elite didn't have to experience this. The ability to travel abroad was also another privilege of status. It meant, of course, access to the wider world, which, of course, further heightened the expectations of the elite. It also meant the very important right to shop abroad. Elite status also gave you better medical care. All Soviet citizens were guaranteed free medical care, but the quality of your care depended on your rank within the hierarchy. Indeed, there were special clinics and doctors for the highest elite, including one, the very best hospital in the country, right across the street from the Kremlin, with no markings of what it was, except for red stars over each of the major doors. Housing was also a perquisite of rank and service. The apartments and also the summer houses, the dachas, of the elite were more spacious, better built, better equipped than the average. As you can imagine, all of these privileges did a great deal to create a loyal managerial class in Russia, a loyal ruling class, one might say, which was one of the keys to the stability of the system. Of course, hierarchical systems, and this was highly hierarchical, if they're to be effective, depend not just on the loyalty of the elite class, but also the recognition by ordinary citizens that the status quo, that the system is somehow legitimate. At least one needs this if you're not going to use regular repression in order to keep order, which was something the regime had decided no longer to use. In Brezhnev's Soviet Union, the state and the party sought this popular acceptance, this tolerance of its rule in a variety of ways. Partly it did so by simply offering people the chance for upward mobility. They, too, could become part of the elite, if you were loyal, if you worked hard, if you joined the Communist Party, a sign of being loyal and working hard, you, too, could enter this elite and enjoy all of these privileges. But the main means of gaining this popular acceptance was by providing the people in large numbers the immediate and tangible benefits of living in the Soviet Union that so many wanted. Some scholars have talked about this as a type of social contract with the population. You accept our rule, we'll give you a decent material life. Some have also called it appropriately a type of socialist welfare state. Now, first of all, this meant the promise that repression would be kept within clear and predictable bounds. It now became much more obvious what sort of behaviors would get you in trouble, would lead to punishment. There was plenty of repression in the Soviet Union in Brezhnev's time. For publicly criticizing the policies, especially in print, you could be arrested. For spending too much time with foreigners unless you had been authorized and agreed to report on your conversations. For what was called damaging socialist property, which included acts such as peasants stealing grain out of fields, or city dwellers going at night into a construction site and taking some wood to try to improve their own apartment. You could also be punished, and many were, for what was called speculation. This meant buying and selling products on your own, apart from the official state market. But repression in these years was not inexplicable. It was not random. People knew they were breaking the law. They knew what would lead them to trouble. Secondly, and really most importantly, was increasingly better material conditions for the majority of the population. This meant, for example, free medical care of a decent quality for all citizens. Quality was not great, certainly not the sort that the elite had. One could, if you had extra money, make a private, though technically illegal, arrangement with a doctor. But still, adequate care was available to everyone at no cost. So adequate, in fact, that many Russians today look back at those times as times when they had much better health care than today. Unemployment was virtually non-existent. It was virtually impossible to fire a worker. And if for some reason your boss fired you because you were so terrible, the state promised to find you a new job. At retirement, everyone was given a state pension. You didn't live easily on this pension, but it was high enough to keep the elderly housed, clothed, and fed. Housing was often cramped. It was often substandard, but rents were subsidized and cheap, and new houses were being built all the time. Food, especially bread and dairy products, were also subsidized. And indeed, the quality of bread, key to, you recall, the revolution, the demand for bread. Bread was especially subsidized, and the quality was actually quite good. Finally, there were major improvements in the consumer economy. Indeed, one of the defining characteristics of these years, at least until the early 1980s, was a continual increase, though at an uneven rate, in both production and per capita consumption. Though there were warning signs of future trouble, already by the late 1970s, the rate of growth consumer per capita consumption began to decline. And by the 80s, there was complete stagnation. More on this later. Until then, though, the standard of living for the majority of the population grew steadily throughout the 1960s and 1970s. Wages and salaries increased, and there was little inflation to cut into them. Food supplies improved. In fact, studies have indicated that the amount of protein in the Russian diet increased in these years, and the amount and variety of consumer goods increased. New housing was also built. It wasn't of the best quality. It often involved long blocks, rather grim blocks, of poorly constructed apartment buildings on the edges of major cities. But still, it was better than the old komunalki, the old communal apartments that had been the norm for most city dwellers before the 1960s. And finally, what formal economic channels couldn't handle was often satisfied in what was called the second economy, or the black market, or the unofficial economy. Here one could find various foreign products that could not be found in official stores, jeans and calculators and record tapes of music and clothing and alcohol and foreign currency, which helped you buy these things. One could find in the black market all sorts of illegally manufactured goods. A collective farmers, often in their non-working time, produced handmade goods, especially during the winter, which they then sold on this illegal market. One could find scarce Soviet goods, and most Soviet goods were indeed scarce, especially consumer goods. One can find them because they were often legally purchased by somebody who saw them for sale in large numbers and then resold them. Technically illegal, but an important place for finding scarce goods if you're willing to pay more. Also, the black market featured goods that were obtained illegally. For example, by truck drivers who would stop on a quiet road out of the way, pull a few goods off, hand it to their compatriot, and later sell it on the black market. Even managers of stores sometimes took a few things out the back door to be sold on the black market. And services, moonlighters of all sorts, plumbers, carpenters, doctors, even acupuncturists could be found during these years serving for a personal payment. It's in fact estimated that something like 25% of the GNP of the late Brezhnev years was part of this illegal market, especially by the early 1980s. The Brezhnev regime tolerated this illegality, for it served a clear economic and indeed social purpose. Big profiteers were sometimes arrested and executed, but the whole system itself was part of this social contract, this welfare state that had been established. Now, to understand what all this means in terms of people's everyday personal experience, one needs to reverse the focus a bit. Not on what the state did to try to ensure popular support, or at least tolerance, but on how people, Soviet people, experienced all this, and how they expressed their needs and their desires. This is important, by the way, not just for understanding the human meaning of Soviet life, though this itself is important, but it's also for understanding part of the cause, maybe one might argue the main cause for the crisis that would bring down this whole communist system in Russia and the Soviet Union, which was a crisis not just about structures, especially about the economy, but it was a crisis about people's attitudes, about their values, about their desires, in particular, which produced a growing alienation from this system. First, it's useful to recognize that these underlying changes in thinking, in expectations, in values that turned so many away from the system, behind these, underlying these, were tangible changes in people's social life. Changes that had effect on how they thought about the world, about their expectations. Changes really in how people lived every day. One of these important changes was urbanization. There's a simple but powerful fact. Beginning in the mid-1960s, Soviet society for the first time became an urban society. Most Soviet citizens lived in cities and towns, not in the countryside, not in state farms or collective farms. They lived often in big cities as well. Consider one telling statistic. In 1926, only 18% of the Soviet population lived in cities. By 1985, 65% lived in cities. And in the European parts of Russia, this urbanization was even more extensive. And city life, of course, exposes people to many things that undermine traditional ways of thinking. New and complex problems, hardships, stresses, new opportunities, various forms of frustrations, new ideas, new attitudes, and relative freedom of city life, giving people a taste for greater personal freedom. No less important, and paralleling this, the USSR became a more educated society in these years. As late, for example, as 1959, already after Stalin's death, fewer than 10% of workers and peasants, the vast majority of the population, had more than 4 years of elementary education, which was the minimum required by law. By 1984, by contrast, 82% of workers and peasants had much more than a primary education. Most had at least 7 years of education, and a large and growing part of the population, including among the lower classes, had secondary education, which allowed them to move into more responsible jobs, technical education, and even university education. All of these groups were growing. And the younger you were, the more likely it was that you were going to see higher education. Related to this urbanization, to this education, to the economic changes that went with it, was the growth of a large educated middle class, something truly new in Russian history at this scale. Office workers, professionals, specialists of all sorts. By 1985, in fact, 30% of the labor force was officially classified as white collar, and half of these had a post-secondary education, some degree of a college education. This is an enormous new middle class with education, living in cities. There were other changes that also affected the way people looked and understood the world. One was a dramatic increase in small private property, something that, of course, was encouraged by the government as it was trying to improve people's standard of living. For example, farmers acquired more private plots of land for marketing produce. And in fact, city dwellers were allowed to also buy from collective farms or state farms, were allowed to buy plots of land where they could spend the summer built with a little house that they might establish there, and they can farm in a modest way for their own consumption or sometimes for selling on the market. Indeed, both farmers and city dwellers spent more and more time, gave more and more of their energies to these little private plots of land, which once more began to produce more and more produce that would show up in the markets. To alleviate the housing shortage, citizens were also encouraged to pool their resources and build cooperatively owned apartments where they had a greater sense of property, a greater sense of ownership. And finally, and most visibly, was a massive spread of small personal property among Soviet citizens, of consumer goods, radios and record players and tape recorders and televisions and refrigerators and washing machines and vacuum cleaners and cameras and pianos and books and furniture and china and glassware and jewelry and clothes. It goes on and on. And much of this was displayed in a prominent place in people's apartments, where one could see the material goods that one owned. One tended not to hide them away in closets. In other words, ironically, developed socialism, as it was called during Brezhnev's years, meant in part that citizens became more bourgeois, one might say, in the sense of materialistic values than at any time since the 1920s. And it became much more of a mass phenomenon. At the same time, it's important to recognize that people's desires and expectations exceeded realities. Most people remained relatively poor. And for those with money, supplies were often short, the goods they wanted to buy were hard to find, and quality was often disastrous. Finally, I would mention, in terms of the social changes that affected people's thinking, was a growing awareness of the larger world, truly a rising cosmopolitanism. Soviet people were increasingly exposed to ideas and images of the West through films and movies and TV, through visiting tourists and business people and journalists, and indeed students, such as I was in the Soviet Union in the early 80s. Also, increasing numbers of Russians were allowed to travel abroad, at least to Eastern Europe or the Baltic states, which seemed to them to be their West, and indeed had a more Western style and manner of life. All of these conditions had a deep and lasting impact on social and cultural and political mentalities of large numbers of Russians, fostering discontent, even dissent. This is my topic next time.
Lecture 35, Private and Public Dissidents.
In this lecture, I look still more deeply at Soviet life in the years after Stalin and before Gorbachev, in particular, the key Brezhnev years of the 60s and 70s and very early 1980s. In particular, I want to look at what has been called or might be called private and public dissidents. This means, of course, the well-known movements we've come to call the dissidents in Russia, but it also means more ordinary and subtle forms of dissension, of alienation, signs, as we now understand, in retrospect, of a system that in many ways was disintegrating from within. First, let me make it clear that most Soviet people were actually quite obedient and conformist, even rather loyal to the status quo. Most people read the Communist Party's official paper, Pravda, and other official papers, as all publications were in the Soviet Union. And in fact, polls among emigres taken in the 1970s indicate that even people who eventually left the Soviet Union tended to believe that most of what was in the paper was probably true. Most people went to political meetings, which were held quite often at almost any place of work. They didn't go with great enthusiasm, but they believed it to be their civic duty to attend these meetings. Most people, in fact, even cooperated with the KGB, with the political police, when called upon to inform about activities at work or meetings, perhaps, with foreigners. And again, assumed to be a civic duty, though not something you'd want to volunteer for. Many people, in fact, sought to join the Communist Party. There were always more applicants than there were actually spaces within the party. The logic of joining the party tended to be more careerist than ideological, more about getting a better position for oneself than about building communism, but still was a sign of the fundamental conformism of most of the population. Most importantly, people generally avoided doing things that were illegal, that were nonconformist, at least in public. This sort of public conformism is in fact not really all that interesting or surprising. Most people in most places, most of the time, are indeed conformist, especially, of course, in a country like the Soviet Union, where the consequences of deviance are so great. What is interesting, what is telling, is that many people, in many ways, and in fact increasingly, did refuse to conform, though often in safer and quieter ways, in less public ways. And that these moments of nonconformism, which became more and more common, were signs of various degrees of widespread alienation among the Soviet population from the official order and the official ideology. First of all, people dissented in scores of rather tiny but significant ways, various what might be called gestures of defiance, but also these should be understood as ways of making life simply more tolerable, giving people human spaces in which they controlled something of their lives. For example, they would attend meetings, political meetings at work, but they would only half listen to the speaker. They sort of knew what it was said. They could read the same thing in the papers. Instead, they knit while at the meetings. Usually this means women. They read the newspaper. They talked quietly among themselves. They sat in the back row and played chess, and all of this was more or less accepted. People, we know, read the official newspapers, but they tended to almost invariably start at the back of the newspaper, not where the political commentary and news was, but where you could find sports reporting or TV information or information about culture. We know that people often came to work late, and tended to work rather haphazardly while they were there. It was not at all unusual to arrive late for work. After all, you couldn't be fired anyway. And sometimes people simply didn't show up, especially